from WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last week when the American Cancer Society announced amended recommendations for when women should begin annual screenings for breast cancer. The new age, according to headlines across the country, 45 for women considered to be at average risk. It's a little more nuanced than that. We're going to get into that. But that 45 number is 5 years later than the previous recommendation, and USA Today called it shocking. For years, many doctors have beat the drum for annual mammograms starting at age 40. But the new guidelines are closer to recommendations announced 6 years ago by a federal task force. So we're going to work through some of those recommendations on timing, frequency, and more this hour. And we'll also talk about a related issue. For women who have needed surgery, what are their options? Many patients choose not to have reconstructive surgery, and we'll talk about the reasons and considerations involved in that process. My guests for the hour include Dr. Avis O'Connell, who's the Director of Women's Imaging at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Avis, every time I see you, I feel like we're talking about new or amended recommendations, so we've got a lot to talk about. Nice to have you here.
Thank you.
Also here is Dr. Howard Langston, who's the Chief of Plastic and Reconstructive Surgery at URMC. Dr. Langstein, nice to have you.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
And Heidi Banser is here. Heidi is a breast cancer survivor and a reconstruction patient who is going on almost 4 years clear. Doing pretty well?
Yes, thank you.
Well, congratulations to you. And we're going to be talking to Heidi about her experience as well. And I want to start with Avis, though, because Avis grabbed me right before we started and said, because I said 45, and you said, well, sort of, but not exactly. And I'm always confused by this, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of people feel the same.
Well, that's exactly the way everybody else is feeling, a lot of confusion. So the 45 could be looked at a good thing because the task force recommendations had been 50, but the previous American Cancer Society recommended had been 40. But what happens is somewhere in between. The new American Cancer Society guidelines say strong recommendation for annual screening beginning at 45 to 55, and then qualified recommendations for starting at 40 and carrying on beyond 55.
I don't know what a qualified recommendation versus a strong is.
Well, later on they said that they'd wish the women would have the decisions themselves and not to have to worry about the financial aspect. So the third part of all of this is who will pay for the different guidelines. I mean, if the task force recommendations were put into law, which they're not quite, they're still in draft, then it's possible that Medicare and then the private insurers may only pay for what the task force recommended, which was every 2 years from 50 to 74 and nothing else. So all the women in their 40s would have nothing paid for, and after 74, all those viable older women would never have it paid for. Well, I just keep going here. I have one more thing.
No, please
there
do.
There is a bipartisan, believe it or not, bill in the Senate and in the House since this summer trying to say, please don't take away the current situation, which is there's no cost, pay, or deductible for a screening mammogram at age 40 until whenever, because women need to know what's going on without having to worry about who's going to pay.
You certainly agree with that, don't you?
Big. We really want, and the American Cancer Society very carefully said that the decision whether to have a mammogram or not should not be that you have to foot the cost or your deductible will pay. It's supposed to have no cost sharing, which means there should be no deductible and no copay on a screening mammogram according to the guidelines. And then everybody says, well, which guidelines?
So what's going on right now? Are people being denied?
No, nobody has ever been denied. So currently, right now, because in 2009, the guidelines came out 6 years ago,
yep.
And they said 50 to 74 every 2 years. But then there was a huge outcry, and Health and Human Services Secretary got involved, and end of the story was nothing was changed. They actually wrote into the Affordable Care Act a very complicated sentence saying the guidelines shall be those other than those recently published, which was interpreted to say we're going back to 2004, which said every year. So bottom line is
every year at 40.
Starting at 40. So right now, anybody who's over 40 years old and it's been 365 days has a no-cost sharing mammogram. That's how it's standing now, but everybody's afraid it's going to be taken away. So
based on this new one?
Based on the new one, both the new one from the Cancer Society and, more importantly, the task force, which is even every 2 years. So the task force recommendations were way worse than the Cancer Society. The Cancer Society said regular every year from 45 to 55, but consider starting at 40 if you want to and you have some risks. And you don't have to stop at 74 if you think you've got another 20 years to go. You know, you should be able to have a screening mammogram. So basically, then they said the Affordable Care Act had the intention that there would be no copay for screening mammograms. So I thought the American Cancer Society's guidelines were very carefully written, and they gave these strong recommendations and qualified recommendations, but carefully said the decision is not to be about the money.
Okay, because when you say that there's a strong recommendation from the Cancer Society to start at 45 for women deemed at average risk,
average
right?
risk.
No,
average.
Family history, things like right. that. But a qualified recommendation at 40, some people might read that to say, if you can afford it starting at 40, do it. And if
you can't, don't.
That's not what they're saying.
No, they said qualified depending on your risks and preferences, because you may have grandmothers and aunts with breast cancer, but not a first-degree relative. And then your preferences. If you say, I don't want anything to do with it, I just can't stand the whole idea, then it's your choice. Nobody's going to drag you in. But they really wanted to emphasize that the big time was 45 to 55. But we all know lots of people who had their cancers found on screening in their 40s. But the government task force was doing a kind of a population assay, not individual people. The Cancer Society allowed that people could get involved and talk about their own risks. And you mentioned a little earlier, how about dense breasts? So there are reasons why some women would prefer to be screened regularly starting at 40, and that they would prefer to continue after 74 and not say, hey, if I get breast cancer, I'll feel it, you know, myself and find it and then don't bother with screening. So, you see, that's where the qualified versus strong recommendations came in.
Okay. Listeners, if you've got questions, we're going to cover a lot of ground this hour on these new recommendations from the American Cancer Society, as well as a conversation about reconstructive surgery and the issues related to that. If you want to join the program with either your own experience or questions you might have, it's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. And already we're seeing questions. Jake writes, as I understand it, the main reason for the changes is to lower false positives. There's a trend of overdiagnosis and overtreatment for both breast cancer and prostate cancer in men. Basically, this is an attempt to dial that trend back a bit. Yes or no, Dr. O'Connell?
Well, I think false positives have to be defined. A false positive, it could be something as simple as a callback for a single extra view to show that an area of tissue is just overlapped, not a real mass. And it usually takes one day and one picture or maybe an ultrasound. And so a false positive doesn't mean you went to surgery for something that wasn't necessary. So I think you have to understand some women are okay with that. They rarely say, oh, I wish you hadn't called me back. They usually say, thanks for being careful. I'm glad there's nothing in there. So we have to understand, but that's where the risks and preferences come in. If there's somebody who's so anxious about anything they ever do, including a blood test for anything, then they need to understand that maybe they should stay and get the results right away, so there's no going away and getting called back. So we have ways of dealing with false positives, and we try and be very aware of the anxieties.
What is the worst case false positive scenario, though?
Well, if 1,000 women have a mammogram, 100 will be called back. That's the 1 in 10. 20 will have a biopsy, and 5 will have cancer. So it's a diminishing, but you see, we don't know when those first 1,000 come in, which of them have cancer. We have to go a little further to find. Because a mammogram is only two views. There's dense tissue, there's areas of calcium. So we need to work it up a little bit. And as we go along, we drop off more. Okay, you're fine, the next person. So of the biopsies, a very small number are cancer. But to find those small cancers, you have to really not ignore any other findings.
Will we get better at this as technology and time goes on?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Yeah. There's lots of ways we are getting better.
Okay. And when it comes to dense tissue, what's the challenge there? How does that change the equation for you and for your patients?
Well, unfortunately, it's a double negative. Dense tissue has a slight increased risk of breast cancer with no other risk except just being dense. And it's harder for us to find the cancers. So it's a double whammy, if you like. There's more cancers in there, a little more, not a lot, but it's harder to find them. So when people have dense tissues, we do other things. We sometimes do tomosynthesis. They're more likely to get a callback. And then we sometimes do ultrasound. Because it's hard. It's hard to tell.
Yeah, it just sounds, as a baseline, it's just going to be harder for you.
Yeah.
Maybe more difficult for them. Maybe more false positives for
Absolutely.
Them.
Absolutely. Yeah. All of that.
And that's difficult, but that's just the way it is for now. Well, what percentage of the population is considered to have dense tissue?
About half the mammograms
About half.
Are dense, yeah.
Wow. Okay. Well, so if you've got more questions and comments there, you can also find us on Twitter, at Evan Dawson, producer Megan Max there as well, at MMAC Media. You can find us there, and we'll relay some of your questions as well as we go throughout the hour. I want to ask Heidi Banner about your own experience, because the initial diagnosis or the way you discovered your own cancer, how did that happen?
I found it myself. I got done nursing my son, and I found my lump and went and got a mammogram And then they did the ultrasound and the biopsy, and a couple days later they called and said I had cancer.
Did you have a feeling pretty quickly, even before you went in?
No, I didn't.
You didn't.
I thought it was a blocked milk duct, to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. And then when I went in for my mammogram and the tech said to me, if the doctor comes in with me, it means you have to have an ultrasound. If not, you're all good. And when the doctor came in, that's when I knew I had cancer.
Tough moment.
Very tough.
Yeah. Well, and again, we're talking to Heidi, who's almost 4 years clear, so it's a really great success story. But her story is, I know you know, it's not unique, but for you then, was there a moment where you think, wait a second, I've got a newborn, this can't be now, it can't be happening?
Oh, absolutely. I thought I was too young. I was 34 years old. I had a baby and a three-year-old at home who I didn't think it would hit me. I thought it happened in older women. So when I discovered the lump and I went in and it was confirmed cancer, it was devastating to me.
Is it in your family?
No, it is not.
It's not in your family.
No, it is not.
Avis, how often do we see that? We're 34, but no prior family history.
Well, the number we like to say is that actually 3/4 of women who get breast cancer have no family history. None. But Heidi mentioned the most important thing is because she was too young even to get screening mammogram by any guidelines, she found something. It was not normal for her. She got it checked. That's the second message, because regardless of mammograms, a lot of women, you know, it'll be between the mammogram or too young for the mammogram. If a woman finds a lump, she should not ask her friend, what is it? And, oh, they had a cyst, so it's got to be a cyst, or your mother, that she had something else. If you have a mass, a lump, you get it checked out. Sometimes when people are very young, we start with an ultrasound and then we do a mammogram as needed. But she did the right thing. And so if she had ignored it, thinking, oh, it's a blocked duct, and waited 3 months, 4 months, and then, oh, maybe it wasn't a blocked duct, she wouldn't necessarily have been as well off. So the earlier you report a finding and get it checked, the better.
Boy, you sound like the model patient in this way.
And
I'm sure you've been told that. But you go throughout the process then, and what was that process for you?
Well, they staged me at stage 3 ductal carcinoma. I went in and I met with my surgeons and the oncologist and Dr. Langstein. I was given an option of reconstruction, which I wasn't too sure of in the beginning, because I wanted them gone. I wanted them off me because it was scary to have them on. So
it's interesting to think of it in that context, but you're thinking at that point just pragmatically, if this is where the cancer is,
I wanted them off. Yeah. I wanted to be there for my children. So yeah. After thinking about it and meeting with Dr. Langstein, and he was amazing when I first went in and spoke with him, and he said to me, I have a hard job, and it's to tell you your options, and here's what your options are. I'm going to give you a few minutes to go over it with you and your family. He came back in, and we talked some more, and I decided that I was going to do the reconstruction, and it was for my own reasons. It wasn't for anything else. It would make me feel better, and that's what I wanted to do, was feel better about myself.
Before we talk to Dr. Langstein about some of that, and again, I know some of our listeners are already calling into the program, and I promise we will get to you, but when you talk about, you know, your own reasons to make you feel better, is that sort of abstractly to feel normal, or you know, take me through a little bit of that process.
I think it is to feel normal, because it's so abnormal at 34 to have a breast removed. And to not have that. So when you look at yourself, you don't feel complete, you don't feel whole. And here I had the option to feel complete and to feel whole again. And Dr. Langstein gave me that opportunity to do that.
What were your concerns or fears? What were the kinds of questions you asked before you said, yes, let's do it?
I asked how long the recovery would be. I asked how many procedures I would have to have. I asked what those procedures would be. There are different types of reconstruction, and you have to qualify for those. And I didn't qualify for the one that I thought I would, so I had to have an implant put in, and I had to have my skin stretched. And then
I don't think I understand the qualification, and I'm sure.
Well,
the doctor,
I don't know if qualification is the right word.
Eligibility.
But there's different ones that they can use different things to reconstruct your breast.
Okay, and Dr. Langstein, what are kind of fill us in on some of more of what she's talking about.
Sure. Qualified, maybe not the best word, but best candidate for is probably better. In general, reconstruction involves either using your own tissue or using implant-based material or using a hybrid type of an approach. Whenever possible, we like to use patients' own tissue because it ages with them. It's their own tissue. It feels better. But these can be big operations, and we'll transfer tissue from one part of the body to the other, sometimes using microsurgery and stitches that are finer than your hair. So it's complicated, long operations. sometimes patients don't have the time or the resources actually to go through the multiple procedures, and so they may want to have a quicker operation, and that generally is an implant-based reconstruction. But in Heidi's situation, there wasn't a lot of extra tissue, so we had to use something off the shelf, basically. And we had to use a stretcher of tissue, a tissue expander, expanded that out to the point where we could then put a more permanent implant in. And then with a few procedures and some little touch-ups, we've gotten to a place where she feels comfortable with her body now. And that's a big deal for patients who have undergone the tragedy that she just described.
How long is recovery?
It depends. You know, the whole reconstructive process takes about a year. About a year from start to finish, to include the nipple reconstruction, the areola tattooing, and so on and so forth. But each operation generally takes a week or two to recover from in the implant type of an operation. But if you use your own tissue, the so-called tram flap, the belly tissue, or the deep inferior epigastric perforator flap, known as the deep flap, if you do those, that recovery can be 4 to 6, if not 12 weeks. So it's a major investment on the part of the patient.
Heidi was just in too good a shape, I guess.
That's it.
That's right. And when women are younger, obviously their tissues haven't had a chance to expand and stretch. Frequently, pregnancy has stretched out the belly so that the tissue then could be used. So a lot of women like to use that operation because they say, well, can you get rid of this at the same time and make me a breast? And frequently we can.
Okay. And so I know a lot of people might be wondering then, is it covered? We kind of hit that a little bit, but the answer to the question of is it covered?
It is.
It's covered.
And this is a federal mandate. If patients have insurance that covers mastectomy, they have coverage for reconstruction.
So you decided to do it. Did you decide pretty quickly after that conversation, or was it kind of more drawn out for you, Heidi?
No, it was. I made the decision that we would go through with it.
Okay. Any regrets or feelings?
Absolutely
that?
None. Yeah? No. He is an amazing doctor.
Sounds like he's got a great bedside manner, too.
Oh, the best.
Which, come on. I mean, I have not been in your shoes, but you'd want a doctor who has a softer touch. And
when a doctor looks at you and tells you and promises you that he will make you feel beautiful again, that's a great doctor.
Wow.
I appreciate that. But I've learned over the years that reconstructing the body is only one part of making patients feel beautiful. It's a matter of allowing them to realize that they are beautiful to begin with, without the breast, with the breast, it doesn't really matter. So our job, of course, is to sort of shepherd them through the process, do what we can for the body, and in Heidi's case, it really turned out great. And so she's giving the credit to that, but I think she needs to take a lot of credit because she adopted this new shape on her chest as her breast, and she's moved on with her life. So I think she's the one who needs to take the credit.
Heidi, for women who will have similar considerations of their own in the future, does it feel, for lack of a better word, normal?
Yes, it does feel normal. It really does. It looks normal. It feels normal. It's amazing.
Okay. And when it comes to your own patients, Dr. Langsteen, less than half are doing this, is that right? Or patients in general who go through this kind of process?
Yeah, the sad statistic is that under 50%, probably closer to 30% nationwide of women who have breast cancer undergo reconstruction. And there are some who perhaps are too elderly or have metastatic breast cancer that reconstruction would not be appropriate. But there are still women who never really have access to reconstruction, perhaps people who are in cities or smaller towns where there aren't reconstructive surgeons. Here in Rochester, we have a number of good reconstructive surgeons, so most patients have access. But that's not enough for us. What we're planning on doing over the course of this next year is to launch a new campaign to coincide with next year's Breast Reconstruction Awareness Day. It just happened last week. We're going to launch a campaign called Reconstruct Rochester. And we're aiming for, over a period of a few years, to make sure that 100% of women in the Rochester area have access to perfect information, good information, that they can decide whether to have reconstruction or not, and have the resources available so that they can have those procedures.
And again, that doesn't mean the expectation or even the hope is that 100% of women who would be eligible would do it. It's having the information.
Absolutely, and information is powerful. There are many women, we find out, have never heard about reconstruction. And then we see them after they've had the mastectomy, and their friend says, oh, by the way, you should have come in and seen somebody. No, it's not appropriate for every woman, but at least if they have the opportunity to read some important material, perhaps watch a DVD that we're planning on producing, and Heidi's going to help us with that, I think they'll be able to make a better informed decision. And I also think that at the end of the consultation, you can see that most patients feel somewhat reassured that they're going to have something at the end of this process. So they feel better able to go through this, the ablative part, or the removal. So they know that there's this sort of pot of gold at the end of the rainbow for them.
And Dr. Langston and Dr. O'Connell, just make sure we understand as well. He mentioned that some women would not be eligible because of metastatic cancer. Do we know what kind of percentages of women who would not be eligible?
Well, I'll say that I can't tell you exactly what percent of women present with metastatic cancer. It's not that common. But generally, what we try to do is, if patients need chemotherapy right away to fight metastatic breast cancer, doing the reconstruction may be a little bit extra surgery that they don't need at that time. Plus, the chemotherapy may lower their immunity, and they may not be able to heal from the reconstruction. So we would then allow them to fight the cancer first and then come back once they've gotten that out of the way.
Okay, let me get to the phones, and if you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255. Greg in Rochester, first up. Go ahead, Greg.
Hi, actually, it's Craig.
Craig, go ahead, Craig.
Thank you for having me on. I'm a family physician in the community, and I just want to, before I say anything, just say that, you know, breast cancer screening and breast cancer in general is it's a very emotional and sensitive subject, and it has a lot of community support. I think one thing that has been overlooked is, you know, exactly what a false positive could be. I know that was mentioned briefly, but also that sometimes the diagnosis of cancer isn't always black and white or straightforward. So, you know, sometimes when we talk about numbers that five women may be diagnosed with cancer, it's not clear to every pathologist, if you gave that slide to 10 different pathologists, that every one of them would agree that it was cancer. And there are certain types of cancer, such as ductal carcinoma in situ, that we're not really clear about what the natural history would be and whether or not that would progress to, say, a metastatic cancer or not. So, you know, the harms of screening really need to be discussed with patients, and the recommendations as far as what age to start screening, I think you could debate pretty rigorously, but just making sure that patients know about harms and what screening may bring if something is seen on mammogram, if something is seen on biopsy. I think those are important discussions to bring up as well with patients.
Craig, thank you. Thoughts from our doctors here?
Well, certainly there's a wide spectrum of findings on mammograms. And initially, it's our job to sort of triage the obvious normals, which there are plenty, they're all set. The obvious cancers where any pathologist would have no doubt that that would be a cancer, we can often tell before we do the biopsy. And then in the middle, there's a wide range of findings. Now, as radiologists, our job is to find the cancer. And if it's DCIS, then it's passed on to the pathologists who have a great expertise in the different levels of there's several kinds of DCIS. And so really when people talk about overdiagnosis, which is what you're referring to, it's like we do the diagnosis. And then as to whether it's treated more than it's needed, that's the overtreatment. So in other words, if you have an 82-year-old woman who has a tiny DCIS, so we would diagnose that because we don't know if it's invasive or DCIS when we see the mammogram. So we do the biopsy, it comes out DCIS, then that woman should have a discussion. If it's really, really low grade, we can watch it until it changes and then becomes invasive. But I have to say, when you tell somebody that they have even stage zero breast cancer, and you say, well, and this has been tried in Massachusetts, in Harvard actually, to say, okay, you have probably a low-grade DCIS. We can watch it or we can remove it. You get very few takers for the watching. I mean, you will occasionally have somebody who's too sick to have surgery. That's different. But when women are told you have a stage zero cancer, it probably over time would progress to invasion. But we don't know if it's going to be 1 year, 10 years, or 20 years. Well, if you're 80 years old, you'd probably say, I'll take the chance. But you see, we don't know that yet. And the pathologists are working on it. And that is the big research right
there's
now.
There's not an average, there's not a good way to get a handle on that, Dr. O'Connell?
Well, the better pathologists are into, I mean, you're looking at a duct and you're looking at an enlarged duct with cells in there. And the difference between atypia, which this doctor recalling in was referring to, an atypical ductal hyperplasia is like only a few cells different from a low-grade ductal carcinoma in situ. But our job as imagers are to find the cancers, make the diagnosis, and then the discussion should go forward as to what's the best treatment.
Craig, any follow-up there?
Am I still on the line?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think you raised some really good points. And I guess just one thing that I'd like to mention is that, you know, you mentioned that you have almost zero takers at the watch and wait approach. And I think that's where some physicians and some people in the community get concerned, is that, you know, we go looking for cancer and then we have nobody who chooses that watch and wait approach, and we end up with more procedures, more anxiety, and spending more money when maybe it might not be necessary. And again, it's something we don't know, but I think it's worth discussing and worth keeping that in mind.
Well, we do welcome
that. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks, Craig.
We do welcome that discussion, and we really want women. I think this is a very good progression over time. Women are getting much more involved in their options. They're given their options, they're given the statistics, and then they make a decision, and they don't have to make it right away. They can talk about it, they can get second opinions, and then they decide how to proceed. What we're afraid of is people afterwards will say, well, you didn't tell me that it might turn into invasive cancer, or you didn't tell me strongly enough. So it's really important for us to try and get the message across with accurate science.
For anyone who might have missed it earlier, again, we're talking about the American Cancer Society's new recommendations that have been, I think Dr. O'Connell has gently reminded me, reported, maybe framed a little inaccurately. It's not just saying, hey, go from 40 to 45 for your first screening if you are considered to be at average risk. They put some qualifications on it. But for anybody who's worried that this new set of recommendations will change what insurance will cover, Dr. O'Connell is saying, do not expect that to happen. Is that fair?
Well, no, we hope it won't happen. Right now, nothing has changed. A screening mammogram is paid. As I said, there's two bills in Congress and in the Senate to try and make sure that nothing changes. Because as written, the Affordable Care Act says screening mammograms and other tests will be covered according to the recommendations. So that's where we all come back again, which recommendations? And the last guidelines from the task force came out this year, and they haven't been made into law yet. So we're trying to prevent that happening. But right now, today, screening mammography is covered.
Are you concerned that that could change?
There is great concern that that would change, because that would save a lot of money. Because, you know, you have to realize that governments make decisions based on populations and cost effectiveness. And so if it's considered not cost effective to save the lives of younger women, because it's more expensive to find cancers in younger women because there's not as much of it, then that's not the discussion we want.
You're saying that would be a mistake.
Absolutely, because we see the cancers and we see the people who are saved basically by finding a cancer when it's small. We know the only thing, most cancers grow, and the younger you are, the faster they tend to grow. So we feel that women should be given the best chance of finding it small, therefore the best treatment, the best outcomes, and carry on with their lives, basically, is what our aim is.
All right, let's get a short break. We're going to come back. Dave in Rochester, we're going to come to you next. He's been waiting on the line to join the conversation. Kim wrote an email to the program with some concerns about how much work time someone might miss if they've got they go through the reconstructive surgery process, which is, again, is a common question, I think. And so Dr. Langstein can help us with that. We have Heidi Banser, who's a breast cancer survivor here, and Dr. Avis O'Connell, who is the director of women's imaging at the University of Rochester Medical Center. More on this conversation straight ahead right here on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, cookbook author, public television host, and restaurateur Lydia Bastianich is in studio with us here in Rochester. She's in Rochester promoting her brand new book. We'll talk about her immigrant success story, why she wanted to write a new Italian cookbook, and more. We'll also talk to Katie Tatar, the host of the new show Fringe Benefits that you can see on WXXI partner stations. It's all next hour, right here on Connections.
This is WXXI AM Rochester, WRUR FM and HD Rochester, WEOS FM and HD Geneva, and WXXI FM HD2 Rochester.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from the Wealth Strategies Group at Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, offering financial planning strategies that are tailored to clients' needs. Canandaigua National Bank and Trust, investing in you.
We were just talking during our brief break about just what a remarkably good decision Heidi Banser made when she thought at age 34, I was a block duck probably. That was what the lump was. But hey, at that point, you're thinking it's probably not cancer. That's not in your head, but you're going to find out.
Yeah, I didn't think it was cancer. I thought it was a cyst or a black milk duct. And I went to the doctor and they sent me for the mammogram and ultrasound and biopsy and all of the rest. fell into place.
And if you missed any of the earlier conversation, everyone's saying thumbs up to that. You've got to know. And in this case, Heidi was in that category. And here she is today doing very, very well. Let's get back to the phones. Dave in Rochester is next up. Go ahead, Dave.
Yes, hello. My wife had a similar circumstance to Heidi, actually. Jen and Heidi were radiation buddies, I guess you'd say. We'd pass her going to and from the waiting room. And she actually had a 15-month-old at the time. And her decision at the point was not to reconstruct. And it's fine with her discussions with Heidi during those times and just talking about reconstructing. It was a very personal decision for her and actually, you know, for, I guess, her whole family as well at that point. And the one difficult thing we had during the time of deciding to reconstruct or not, that if you did some research, you found plenty of pictures, information about what the reconstructed breast looks like. What we didn't have really was what does an unreconstructed chest look like. And so I think as going forward, if, you know, as awareness is being built, giving people both pictures to take a look and see what the differences are would be very helpful. And, you know, my wife is very pleased with her outcome. Her body habitus was much better for, you know, was much more, I think, accepting of not reconstructing. In the back of her mind, I think she always thinks that at some point reconstruction could be possible. And I believe in New York State, if you do want to reconstruct down the road, that is a possibility. But I do think getting as much information out there as you can is fantastic. I love the awareness, pushing it to let people know, yes, reconstruction is there. But also, you know, making it acceptable for those folks who also choose not to reconstruct. And there's no right or wrong answer here. It's just a matter of, you know, I think more discussion with providers and providing more information. But, you know, I think in the end, as a husband, you know, it's important, I think, for us to talk about, you know, with our wives, okay, you're beautiful at the time that you walked into the operating room, and, you know, my wife's just as beautiful now 4 years later, even though she has no breasts. And it's one of those things that I think is, you know, important to keep in mind during the discussion as well.
Well said, Dave. Thank you very much for that. And I don't think you'll get any pushback at all. The way I've taken the conversation, especially listening to Heidi and Dr. Langstein, is it's what a person's comfort level is. It's what might make them feel comfortable going forward, or for lack of a better word, normal going forward. And it might be different for everybody, Dr. Langstein.
It really is. And I'm glad we heard what it's like from the husband's perspective, because really there's a whole family that gets reconstructed here. And but it's an intensely personal decision. And that's why when we counsel our patients about reconstruction, we provide them with options. I can't say, you're a good candidate for this, have this. You'll frequently mislead people if you do it that way. And you have to sort of dance with the patient and figure out what is it that's going to make them tick. And a lot of it's sort of reading the body language and the nonverbal behavior about how the patients are dealing with. Some patients are so distraught about the cancer diagnosis that they can't even listen to the options during the reconstructive discussion. And so some of those in situations, what we'll do is we'll say, you're not ready for reconstruction. We'll do it after everything is all healed up. We'll come back later on. And interestingly, though, those are patients who tend to be way more grateful for reconstruction because they've lived with the non-reconstructed situation. So it's interesting how the human mind works. But getting back to the situation at hand, and that is, I can't tell what patients are going to want until after we show them either pictures or have a description. And I like the caller's mention of showing a non-reconstructed breast too. Probably our breast surgeons ought to show that to patients and say, this is what it's going to look like when you're done.
Okay. And again, not as a negative, just as information. Absolutely. And what would you say to Dave, Heidi?
Oh, I agree. It's so personal, and I think you have to look at the family dynamic. You have to look inside yourself and find out what is best for you and what meets the need. And if it's not getting reconstructed and that's your choice and you're okay with it, that's great. But if you want to have the reconstruction, go forward with it and see what your options are.
Did you feel support around you with that decision?
Absolutely. My mother supported me, my husband supported me, and my two little guys supported me. So, yes, absolutely. And walking into the office, every appointment that I had when I saw Dr. Langstein, I felt 100% supported at every level.
Email from a listener named Kim said that she didn't want to get into too much of her own story other than to say that missing work, that was the big problem with the consideration of reconstruction. So, Dr. Langstein, I suspect you've heard that many times.
Yes.
Okay. What's realistic? And again, if I'm remembering the earlier part of the conversation correctly, if you can use a patient's own tissue, it's a shorter process, yes?
The other way around. If the transfer of patient's own tissue tends to be a longer recovery.
Oh, that's a longer recovery.
Yeah. And so if, for example, if we use abdominal tissue, the tram flap or the deep flap, you can expect to be out of work 4 to 6 weeks, if not a little bit longer. The shortest it's ever been has been a patient of mine who went back to work 1 week after an operation like that and only took Tylenol. She's an outlier on that side. And there have been patients who've decided that they have gone through enough and they choose not to go back to work. So there's a whole spectrum. But I would expect 4 to 6 weeks of being off of work, but it depends on the type of work that you do. If you're sitting at a desk, you might be able to get back sooner. Interestingly, if you're self-employed, you get back a lot faster.
Well, I understand that point. As someone married to someone who owns their own business, you never really stop working. But how many different procedures throughout the course of this kind of treatment, again, because reconstruction doesn't happen in one kind of fell swoop, right?
That's right. So in the case of putting a tissue expander in, usually you're not going to miss much more work than if you just had a mastectomy, so it's a couple of weeks probably.
Okay.
And then after that area has been expanded up, and I use a technique where I expand a lot early on, and then probably about 3 months later, there's another operation where that implant is actually replaced with the more permanent silicone implant. And then later on, the operation would be a small little procedure in the office to make a little nipple and then a little tattoo. And those last two are not really operations. So 4 procedures over the course of 6 months to a year.
But not every procedure is going to require time out from work?
Exactly. And the last two require no time off of work. But the implant-based reconstruction is patients seem to get back to work rather promptly. And if they have to come in for a little expansion, they can do that on their lunch hour, and it's not really unpleasant to them.
All right. If you want to call the program with more comments or questions, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. Another email from a listener just wants to know what the doctor in the room, when you are privately counseling patients, are you going to say, Dr. O'Connell, well, forget about what the American Cancer Society just said about 45 and, you know, start at a different time?
Well, I usually do say that we see the individuals. We're not talking about full populations. And we say that, you know, you can, you know, that breast cancer will happen in somebody who has no family history, breastfed their kids, did everything healthy. There's no reason. So I would say, why wouldn't you? But it's your decision. And so I do recommend that people get an annual mammogram, because the worst thing, can you imagine if somebody skips a couple of years and then there's something that could have been picked up 1 or 2 years earlier? Because we do know that the smaller cancers are easier to treat and more likely to, you know, to not have spread and all those things. So, yeah, when people ask me one-on-one, I say, absolutely. But then people would think I'm the radiologist. Of course, it's my business to do mammograms. But really, in an individual case, I think I say to people, look, I think, well, it's up to you. Do your risk, the risks of a callback and a possible false positive, which is a callback, outweigh the benefit of finding something earlier, and it's an individual decision.
I wouldn't be doing my journalistic duty if I didn't mention that we have at least one listener on Twitter who said, well, both doctors have something to gain by reconstructive surgery and more mammograms. Well, first of all, Heidi, you're already shaking your head at that. I'll let you weigh in first before we take that allegation to the doctors. But what do you say to that, Heidi?
I disagree with that. I mean, just in my experience alone, every single doctor that I've had and worked with or has worked with me, I have never felt like I was just a patient or a number or a way for them to gain money. They want me to be better. They want me to be healthy, and they want to see me be healthy for the rest of my life. So I disagree with that.
Dr. Langstein?
Well, we're in the business of helping people. And when people come into our office and ask for our services and we offer them, that's what we're all about. We turn away patients for reconstruction. If we were just turning this into a business.
Patients who want reconstruction.
Some patients who are not even good candidates for reconstruction, we'll say, you're not a good candidate, and we'll turn them away. So we only offer it to the patients who are proper candidates for it, and their outcome is our outcome. And when they're happy, we're happy. So I really don't know how to respond to that other than we're just doing our job.
Okay.
Well, I have one. When I went from private practice to university practice, I was able to say to people that at this point, if I do something, my salary doesn't change the more I do. I actually can very comfortably tell you that I do what's best for the patient because my bottom line doesn't change whether I do 5,000 mammograms or 6,000 mammograms.
Dr. O'Connell, is there any age at which you would recommend going to every other year instead of every year for screening?
Well, I think older. I think if somebody's in their 70s or 80s and they have a very low density breast and they have no risk factors, that every other year would be fine. I do. But, those are actually the ladies who tend to feel like they want to come. They say the peace of mind is worth a lot. Anybody who's seen somebody go through breast cancer, and we all have friends, family, and they say, if I can prevent myself having that kind of a situation. So the older ladies tend to come more regularly once they're in the routine. And I think that's a good feeling for them.
Talking about breast care, and the female listeners are communicating online. The phones are our male listeners. Steve in Rochester. Next up. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Sure.
I would just like to ask the speakers to clarify some of the issues relating to frequency of screening, because I think this is the epidemiology and statistics involved get very complicated, talking about things like lead time bias and concepts that are hard for people in the field to understand, let alone the lay public. You know, we're getting into this now with other cancers like lung cancer, where screening by CAT scan is being advocated. And at the bedside, if you're dealing with an anxious patient, of course people will want to be screened, given some comfort. But I think the frequency of screening really needs to be made almost at a societal level. That's what these societies and preventive task forces are trying to do, to help us understand as a kind of society who's paying for these screening processes, at the end of the day, does it really impact quality of life? And I think that's a very, very hard decision to have at the bedside. And I would just want to make sure the panel and that message gets out. So I'll thank you for hearing that out.
Thank you, Steve. Thoughts, Dr. O'Connell?
Well, that's the difference between counseling an individual patient at the bedside and making decisions based on the population and made by the government. The government is looking at the entire country. I'm looking at individual patients. So I will counsel somebody based on their individual risks, preferences, family history, etc. But I do understand that in places which have less resources than we do, in some countries the screening is every 3 years, and in some countries there's no screening at all. So it really depends how much we as a society value the early detection of breast cancer. And I think the women's advocacy groups have made that quite clear, that women want to have the option, and it's their option. They want to have the option to be screened and to have early detection. And so it's a discussion, though, because it is more expensive to screen the entire population than not.
Back to the phones, and Joanne in Pittsford next up. Go ahead, Joanne.
Yes, hi, thank you. As a breast cancer survivor, my question is, in diagnosing breast cancer early on, isn't it important to detect it, because depending on where it is in the breast, if it's near a node where it could spread, isn't early diagnosis important in that regard? Because I know it's not only the stage it's at, but where exactly the cancer is, because of the sentinel node. If you can elaborate on that, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you, Joanne. Dr. O'Connell?
Well, most cancers statistically occur in the upper outer quadrant of the breast, and that's close to the axilla or the armpit where most sentinel nodes exist. But really, we look at all four quadrants of the breast. Cancers can be detected in any quarter of the breast, and some lymph nodes spread to the center rather down the midline instead of going to the axilla. So we don't, certainly we look harder in the upper outer quadrant just because that's where more of the cancers are, but we look at each part of the breast equally. And I think women's outcome is more dependent on the size and aggressiveness of the tumor than exactly where in the breast it lies.
A question via email from Teresa, who writes, Hi, Evan, without getting into a lot of detail, I was diagnosed in 2003, and since my treatment included radiation, I had to wait until 2006 to even... Oops, sorry about that. Let's make sure that last call is... Look at the host. Still getting used to my new digs again. We were out of here for a day. Teresa, let me go back over that again. Teresa says, without getting into a lot of detail, I was diagnosed in 2003, and since my treatment included radiation, I had to wait until 2006 to even talk about reconstruction. Is that still the case, or have the protocols changed since then?
Yeah, the protocols have changed. If patients have had radiation, we're much more apt to reconstruct within about a year of the conclusion of the radiation therapy. And that's because the radiation has an impact on blood vessels beneath the surface. And if we're using microsurgery to connect tissue up, we want the greatest chance of success. So about a year for that. For patients who've had radiation, we're much less likely to put implants in if their patients have been radiated. So they'd need to have some form of their own tissue, or at least a hybrid type of an operation.
Okay, and another caller off air just wanted to go back over a point that we've talked about, which is coverage, and the question framed this way, is elective reconstruction paid for by the patient, or does it depend on the insurance company?
Well, technically it does depend on the insurance company, but the federal mandate is that if the insurance company pays for the mastectomy, they have to pay for reconstruction. Now, what's getting a little confusing now is whether we can operate on the other breast to sort of create some symmetry. And usually it's covered, but the payers are getting way more selective and thinking that some of this might be cosmetic. But by and large, it's all covered by insurance.
Okay. And, you know, you just heard Dr. Langsteen talk about protocols and how they've changed since 2006, for example, when a listener named Teresa asked about her own situation. You talk about going back several decades, and Dr. Langsteen, before the program, you told me that there was a time when people in your profession thought full removal was always the way to go, as opposed to partial, and so that's another example of how things have changed, right?
Absolutely. I mean, if you think of the most extreme example of a mastectomy, known as a Hall-Steadian radical mastectomy, it's a mutilating type of an operation, where much of the skin and muscle is removed, and then a skin graft is placed in the chest. That was thought of as the treatment. And then less radical techniques have been developed over the years, and it's taken a lot of courage and data for doctors to recognize that if you do a partial mastectomy, you could have the same survivorship as if you have a full mastectomy.
Dr. O'Connell, where do you think we're going? Where are we going to be 20 years from now in terms of treatment?
Oh, treatment or diagnosis?
Well,
I'm diagnosis, remember?
The diagnosis, and that is what I want to know. 20 years from now, how do you expect that could be changing?
I would wish we could have something better. I mean, the mammography today is way better than it was 20 years ago, and now we have tomosynthesis, which we don't really get into. But there's three ways of screening. There's mammograms, there's ultrasound, and there's MRIs. And then there is also something called gamma imaging. I mean, we're always looking for a better way to find cancers without finding the unimportant ones, like the low grade or whatever. So hopefully we'll continue improving different imaging methods. But right now, I have to just say this, the gold standard is still the mammogram. We do have people saying, I hate the mammogram, could I just have the ultrasound? Or I hate both of those, could I just have an MRI? But right now, the gold standard is the mammogram, and it's pretty good. It's way better than it was 20 years ago, and we're continuing to find ways of getting it better and keeping the radiation down. So I would hope that it'll just keep getting better.
Okay. Heidi, what are some closing thoughts that you would want to share with our listeners who, you know, unfortunately, a lot of women will end up in the same position that you were in, whether it's at 34 or 44 or 54 or older. What's the oldest diagnosis you've ever made, Dr. O'Connell?
90s.
90s?
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm telling you, the older ladies come in like clockwork, and we take good care of them. But, you know, you would have to have the discussion, like how much, the most they would ever have would be a lumpectomy. Mm-hmm. Somebody of that age would never have a mastectomy, and Dr. Langsteen is nodding. Yeah. But, I mean, they feel better when the tumor is removed from their breast. So that's why, and it's peace of mind, and we hope they'll fall asleep in their 100th year instead of dying of breast cancer.
Let's go with 110. I'm an optimist as well. Yeah, I'm an optimist as well on that. But Heidi, what do you want to leave our listeners with, who, no matter what their ages, may end up in your position?
I would just like everyone to look at the options that are out there for them and make the decision based on what's best for them. And if you go to the right doctor and you have the support from your family, your friends, and your medical team, you can make an informed decision that's best for you.
Did you find yourself learning more than you ever thought you'd learn about the subject?
Absolutely. I feel like I'm very versed in it.
But as daunting as that was, you were able to get up to speed pretty quickly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's really, really good news. Dr. Langsteen, some closing thoughts from you, and especially, I guess, as we go toward 2016 when we're talking about Reconstruct Rochester. What do you want to leave the audience with?
Well, look forward to seeing more about this great campaign that we're going to put forward. And we will be, over the course of the year, putting together a high-quality video presentation that all patients have an opportunity to read, to look at, and to make the proper choices like Heidi did. And hopefully you ask the question, what's the future look like? The future is we're going to cure breast cancer. That's going to happen. It's going to be cured. But until that happens, I think plastic surgeons will need to be around to at least provide these types of services to patients, because right now it's become a chronic disease. We cure patients. They're around for a long, long time. And we have to make them feel normal again. And that's our job.
Nanotechnology, that could be part of it. We'll see. Dr. O'Connell, you're shaking your head there. You're not down with that. Well, we'll see. We'll see.
I'm down with it.
One of these days, one of these days. 20 seconds or so, what do you want to leave the audience with as they think about these recommendations and guidelines?
That they should really understand that screening mammography is really the reason why mortality for breast cancer has gone down 30%, in my opinion.
And mammography, mammograms are still
the gold standard.
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. O'Connell. Great to have you. Thanks for answering so many great listener questions, Dr. Langsteen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. And Heidi, Heidi Banzer, coming up on 4 years clear, and congratulations to you and continued good health in the future.
Thank you.
Short break, and Lydia Bastianich in studio with us next.